We are a nation that's built on argument. That's the first point that I want to make. And I want to root that in a reflection of how our Constitution came into being. To the possibility of governing a nation by a constitution was a relatively new way of being in the colonial times of our country. During those colonial days, what we call now as the United States of America were very content functioning at a state level. States had been designing and redesigning their constitutions, and that lasted up through 1776. In fact, many church bodies of the time as well were comfortable putting together constitutions to govern their church structures. Henry Muhlenberg proposed a governing agreement in the 1760s, which this congregation adopted and we still use as our governing documents even to this day. These constitutions that led and guided the states were based on precedents that had been used throughout the colonial rule of the United States. And they had worked for the most part, and people were comfortable with them. But to propose now instead a way of governing the whole nation, a national government, met with resistance in the colonies. It met with resistance because it was perceived that it threatened the power of the states. And also it was very fresh in the minds of people that they had just fought a war to get rid of a national government. So they're very skeptical about what a national government would do for them. So any move that was put into place to establish a more formal government met with resistance. What came out of that movement for national government is what is known as the Articles of Confederation. It took 12 months to pull these articles together. It took another 3.5 years to put them into place. They were finally ratified just 7 months before the Revolutionary War came to its conclusion. It was clear, however, that there were flaws to these Articles of Confederation. Thomas Paine wrote in Common Sense, in reference to the Articles of Confederation as a continental belt, that the continental belt remained too loosely secured. There wasn't anything binding the nation together. These are some of the flaws that existed in those Articles of Confederation, and I'm borrowing heavily from the work by Professor of American History at MIT, Pauline Meyer, and her book, Ratification. The first challenge to the Articles of Confederation was once the war ended, the perceived need for a national government disappeared. There wasn't an enemy, there wasn't a threat, and so there was no need to bind together against a common enemy. Another flaw of these Articles of Confederation is that the national government had no money. Does that sound familiar? The problem is they had no money to levy taxes, and the people had no desire to pay taxes. That hasn't changed much either. But this nation had incurred large amounts of debt to other nations fighting the Revolutionary War. And the fear at that time was that this nation was going to default on its debt to its international lenders. Does that also not sound familiar? One member of Congress wrote that our funds are exhausted, our credit lost, and our confidence in the federal government has been destroyed. The national government could not regulate trade, and so states were out regulating their own trade, many times at the risk of hurting another state. The national government could not raise a peacetime army, nor did they have any authority of a coercion to enforce any laws that existed. And the decisions that the national government made at that point, George Washington describes as this. These are people that were led by the insecurity of property, the loss of confidence in their rulers, the lack of public faith and rectitude, to consider the charms of liberty as imaginary and delusive, and this tendency to adopt almost any change that promised quiet and security. Because of those flaws in the way that the nation was governed, the Congress decided to pull together a convention in May of 1787. The purpose of being that this group of leaders that came together would provide recommendations for how the Articles of Confederation could be improved. And in May of 1787, this convention gathered in Philadelphia. George Washington was elected as its leader, and they met from May of 1787 until September of the same year. But instead of coming out with recommendations for the Articles of Confederation, instead the group presented a new government and presented a constitution to guide that government. The expectation was then that this recommendation for a new government and a new constitution would be sent to the Congress. They would then ask each state to ratify the constitution. Once it was ratified, it would become the governing document, the governing doctrines of this nation, and provide for a new government. Now, I think it's important for us to grasp how this process happened. Because first of all, it points out that the recommendation is that our nation is led by a series of doctrines that aren't religious and aren't rooted in any monarchy. The second is that it was the expectation that the people of the nation would vote to ratify that. It engaged all of the people. And third, because all of the people were engaged in that conversation, it set the precedent for us that the decisions that govern our nation come out of argument. The engaging of one person with another in public discourse for the purpose of coming up with that which will be beneficial and good for the land. So we are a nation that is built on argument, point and counterpoint, public discourse, for the purpose of achieving resolutions that are good for the nation and its people. That is built into who we are. The hope is that civil public discourse will indeed be what governs our nation. There are, however, challenges that were present when the Constitution was proposed that continue to be present now that challenge whether that discourse is civil or not. Once again, I want to rely on Professor Meyer to unpack some of these challenges to discourse that is civil. The first challenge to a civil public discourse is the fear of crisis and chaos. In September of 1787, Alexander Hamilton, who was trying to calculate what the odds were that the Constitution would be ratified, said this if the ratification failed. He believed that the results would be catastrophic. that there would be civil war, dismemberment of the Union, and the establishment of monarchies in various parts of the colonies. He was afraid that if something didn't happen, everything would fall apart. That is rooted in the hearts of every single person. The fear of crisis, the fear of chaos. And if I had my way and could ban certain words from the English vocabulary for 10 years, I would ban the word whatever from our children's mouths. And I would ban the word crisis from the media. That ongoing fear that everything is going to fall apart at any second. And that fear leads not to civil public discourse, but panic and knee-jerk reactions. Coming out of that fear of chaos is, I think, a second challenge to this civility, which is the need to act immediately. This fear that we are running out of time. Right after the Constituting Convention finished up in September of 1787, the Pennsylvania Assembly reclaimed that room in Philadelphia. The goal being that the Pennsylvania Assembly could be the first state to ratify the Constitution. Benjamin Franklin was the president of Pennsylvania at that point, and he was pushing for that rapid ratification of the Constitution. And he also proposed that Pennsylvania would set aside a 10-mile square part of the state, because if Pennsylvania was the first state to ratify the Constitution, then it goes without saying that the national government would be located in Pennsylvania. There were many in the assembly who didn't think that the process should move that fast. And so their technique was to leave the assembly so that there wasn't a quorum present, so that they couldn't vote and couldn't take action. The more things change, the more things stay the same. Well, they wanted to push this through, and word came out that there were two assemblymen who were hanging out at a pub down the street from where the assembly was meeting. They needed two more to make the quorum. And so the sergeant-at-arms of the assembly found Mr. McCalmont and Mr. Miley, and they grabbed them by force, and they drug them back to the assembly hall, and they locked the doors and stood in front of them so that they couldn't leave. They declared they had a quorum, and then proceeded to pass the resolution. Now, Mr. McCalmont, trying to delay the process, did put a motion forward that the elections would not happen in Philadelphia, but happen either in Carlisle or in Lancaster was his other choice. The need to act immediately. And Professor Meyer points out that the framers of the Constitution realized the political damage they did to the process by forcing something so large and contradictory through the system so fast actually hurt their cause. Because people who would have been for it held back, not trusting what was happening. Paul Leite, in a book entitled Government's Greatest Achievements, which sounds like an oxymoron, does it not? I knew about this book, and I was trying to search for it on Google, and I kept putting in the greatest achievements of, and all of these options came up until I put the word government, and then the screen went blank every time. Even Google has a hard time acknowledging there could be achievements from government. But he did a study from 1951 to 2001, and he lists what he thinks are the 50 greatest achievements of the American government. And he makes this observation that America rarely conquers its problems in an instant. Rather, it tends to wear problems down year after year, law after law, until victory is won. And in talking about those accomplishments, he writes, despite what may have seemed like insurmountable odds at the time, the federal government has helped rebuild Europe after World War II, conquered polio and a host of other life-threatening diseases, faced down communism, attacked racial discrimination in the voting booth, housing, and the public square, and has reduced poverty among the nation's elderly to its lowest levels in modern history. The point being, it was accomplished through time and hard work and not a quick fix. There's also an obstacle to civility whenever we require unanimity among all those involved, that everyone will be of the same mind and completely agree. It was fascinating at the conclusion of the Constituting Convention, George Mason, who was against this Constitution, wrote that he would sooner chop off his right hand than put it to the Constitution the way it now stands. But you must also be aware that James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, Governor Morris, Henry Knox, Benjamin Franklin, and George Washington also had reservations about what they had produced. But they were willing to set aside their own concerns to make that personal sacrifice out of a genuine concern for the well-being of the nation and the well-being of its people. They weren't of like mind, but their passion for this nation trumped their personal need to be right. Another obstacle to this civility is what happens when there is a conflict, and that is each side of the conflict assumes that they are more enlightened than the other side of the conflict. One essayist in the time of the ratification process named Sentel claimed that there was no crisis, that these are simply exaggerated fears that are out of place as the frenzy of enthusiasm for this Constitution. And this occasion calls for a free and unbiased discussion, which only he was able to offer. So he invited all who were, his words, capable of understanding the abstruse science of government to help people make a proper judgment on the Constitution. The sense that one side is more enlightened than the other in a disagreement. It gets expressed even today when we are made aware that our president is working harder than our Constitution, our Congress, to resolve this issue with the debt ceiling. We see that sense of enlightenment when the temptation is to vote for a corporate executive as our next leader, thinking that somehow they know how to manage better than those who are in public office. The sense of I get it and you don't becomes an obstacle to civil public discourse. And the final fact that I want to point out is the use of the press, which becomes an obstacle to civil public discourse as well. Early on in our nation, the press was very intentional about covering all the bases because they needed a wide readership in order to make sure that all of their bills got paid. During the time of the revolution against Britain, There was a movement among the newspapers to not allow loyalists to publish articles in the papers because they would speak supporting of the British government. But once they moved beyond that time, there was a sense of equality among those who offered their feedback. The Philadelphia Freeman's Journal described themselves in this way: open to all parties, but influenced by none. I guess they beat Fox to fair and balanced, didn't they? But what we see happen is that many people who were writing against the Constitution chose to use pen names for fear that they would receive retribution for being against this movement. And one of the techniques that newspapers used was to refuse to publish any articles by people who didn't sign their real names to their articles, which helped exclude opposition to the Constitution. And as newspapers started to realize that they had a certain clientele that was what was keeping them into business, they also started catering to that clientele. We must be aware that our media is a for-profit corporation. And they may have the mission to provide us with the news, but we always must lay that layer of corporateness over top of them because they are for-profit corporations. It was fascinating, I think it was yesterday, on Fox and Friends. They were interviewing one of the Republican candidates, and they were pointing out the article that was in Time magazine this week about the Constitution. And the cover photo is of the Constitution being run through a paper shredder. And Herman Cain, who was being interviewed, said that, you know, it points out that there are different perspectives on how we approach the Constitution. Some want to throw it out, some want to be legalistic, some thinks it needs to expand with the situations that we face. And Clayton Morris, who's one of the personalities that morning, said, but we need to remember that if it weren't for the Constitution, Time magazine wouldn't have been able to run that picture. Freedom of press was not in the Constitution. That came later. And that was one of the critiques of the early Constitution, was that freedom of press was not in there. We are a nation built upon argument to engage in civil public discourse for the purpose of making decisions that are good for the nation and its people. But there are stumbling blocks that keep that discourse from being civil. I believe that there is a Christian witness that we as a church can bring to public discourse. And when we speak of the fear of chaos, we as Christians are able to witness to a God who brings order out of chaos. That God is authority over all of heaven and earth, and over every government on the face of the earth, and that God can bring order out of the most fearsome chaos that faces us. We have a Christian witness to this need to have solutions immediately. For we as Christians believe that we have the gift of time. That as we bring past, present, and future together in the gospel of Jesus Christ, we have, brothers and sisters, the gift of time. It is not a knee-jerk reaction. We have a Christian witness to this call for everyone having to agree on everything. in that we know that we bring our own brokenness and our own devices and our own desires to the conversation. And we are brilliant at rationalizing our own sins in very logical ways and then arguing it from that perspective. We allow room for failure and mistakes. We have a Christian witness to this belief that some are more enlightened than others. A risk that I'm running today in framing this conversation for you, that somehow I'm more enlightened right now because I can frame this conversation for you. A Christian witness is rooted in this call for meekness and humility. The word for meekness is rooted in the French word for debonair. You know what debonair literally means? The ability to relate to every kind of person at whatever level they are at. As one military chaplain told me this week, military chaplains function that whoever they are with, they are the same rank as the person they are with. There's no sense of being more enlightened than the other person. And we have a Christian witness to the power of the media. The power of the media, which is rooted in this claim, if they say it, it must be so. That somehow, if it is announced on television, if it's in a magazine, if it's written in a paper, it must be the way it is. I panicked whenever I heard that the average 4th of July picnic is going to cost $61 this year. That's up $9 from last year. And my wife rationally said, you know what? How many people does that include? What kind of food are you serving? Where is the picnic at? I just took that conclusion and didn't ask any questions. The same report shared with us how horrible it is because of the economy that more people are staying home for the 4th of July this year. Is that so bad? And the other trap we fall into with the media is that stories of different levels and of importance are all brought to the same plane. Let's look at the front page of the newspaper yesterday. International issues, state issues, local issues, and also an article that starts at the top of the page and goes all the way down about new DNA tests for dog poop. If you have a problem with your neighbor's dog doing his business in your yard, there is now a solution. You get this test kit, you test its DNA, you test your neighbor's dog DNA, and you can prove without a shadow of a doubt to your neighbor that it is his dog doing his business in your yard. When it's all on the front page of the newspaper, the message it sends, it is all the same importance. We have a Christian witness to offer, especially in light of the fact that there are stumbling blocks to civil public discourse. And that is the reason why we are taking on this series, why next week Professor Carey will be with you and brings his vast expertise in the area of rhetoric to talk about the kind of speech we use and hear. The following week, we'll take a look at how the Christian community has actually been a stumbling block to civility in our nation. The fourth week, we'll take a look at the kind of language we use that honors the integrity of other people and brings about inspiration and the capacity for life. And the last week, we will lay out, based on our ministry plan, an academy for public discourse, how we as a congregation in this community can take the first steps to bringing about civil public discourse that benefits the nation and the people who are its residents. Amen.